Well, hello, good afternoon. Sláinte, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, joining you from my secret bunker underneath the Blacksmith Fountain in downtown Guelph. It's not so secret, I guess, if you give that away. Yeah, the Blacksmith is actually an antenna. And joining me on the line, hopefully, from the Crow's Nest is Adam A. Donaldson. Adam, are you indeed there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, excellent.
I sure am.
Yeah, we haven't missed one of those yet, have we? I need to stop saying that, because one day we will, and it'll just be like, oh, yeah. Anyway, on that note, coming up on the program in the second half of the show, Adam spoke to Councillor Dan Gibson from Ward 1, I believe mostly about the budget, but I'm sure they covered a bunch of issues, and we will get to that at the 5:30 mark. But before that, we're going to talk about a bit once again about the COVID-19 situation, in particular Dr. Williams in Ontario, who is a chief medical officer and advisor to the government. And there's been some talk about Dr. Williams over the past, not just recently, but over the past few months, as to whether he's the right person for the job. But before that, Adam, and this is obviously a bit of a breaking story, because I did see there was a bit of a press conference this afternoon regarding vaccine distribution in Canada. Major General Danny Fontaine, who is handling the, I believe they've given him a title now, it was the Vice President of Public Health, is that right? I believe so. Did you catch any of that, or...?
No, it went right by me, unfortunately, because I just was the way I was working this afternoon.
Action-packed. Yeah.
It was action-packed, yeah.
Well, anyway, so what I can talk about what's happening, if people haven't heard yet, that they're going to have a dry run of vaccine distribution, as they've been talking about. It sounds like they've been doing some of that already, in particular focusing on the Pfizer vaccine because of its... It's the one that has to be kept at minus 85 degrees, so there are logistical concerns about it. And the Major General was actually sounding very confident, as I guess Major Generals do, is probably the person you want on the job, because the military have divisions that handle logistics and these kinds of things to be able to distribute it. And if I understand it right, the Pfizer vaccine is being manufactured in Michigan, so that lends itself to a better situation for... Well, good chunks of Canada, at least. I thought it was going to come from Belgium, because that's where the UK supply is being made. So they, I guess, they have different hubs and different continents and different places to supply. But that was very positive to me. I mean, it sounds like there may be actual bona fide rollout by the end of the month, as they are doing in the UK on an emergency basis.
Yeah, there are a lot of balls up in the air, and I think one of the frustrating things in sort of watching this happen is that there is so much impatience about getting going on this that nobody's really patient, or I guess is the thing.
It's wearing a bit thin, yeah.
It's wearing a bit thin. I mean, Doug Ford had a presser earlier this week where he was like, I don't understand. Like, we're putting millions and millions of dollars in. Why can't they give us, like, a launch date? And it's like, dude, it's not a sticker. It's, you know, not only did...
Slap it on.
I mean, really, right? Not only did four different pharmaceutical companies come up with a vaccine to a disease we didn't even know existed this time last year. There's, I guess that sums it all up, is that we didn't know there was a disease called COVID-19 this time last year. It hit us hard in March, and 10 months later we have a vaccine, and that it's at least going to start rolling out at the end of this month, if not earlier in 2021. And the question is, like, are we so fragile that we can't wait for these things to unroll in real time, even if it just means waiting another extra couple of weeks and or months to sort of get that information? Like, is the matter so desperate that, I mean, yes, part of it too is that we want to make sure the government is doing it and doing it right. But a lot of this is being governed by our health regulations and our public health professionals, who we do trust to give good advice on when and how to roll things out at least 98% of the time. So, you know, let's chillax a bit. There's still a long road to go.
It is unfortunate that there are people out there trying to score political points on this, although everyone will insist that that's not what they're doing. I saw a fantastic tweet today, actually, that I really want to share, and it was about Erin O'Toole. Said Erin O'Toole is demanding a definitive date that Derek Sloan can refuse a vaccine. So... if well, people I mean, don't know the story, Derek Sloan is it's a petition that's got 22,000 signatures that will in all likelihood be read into the record in Ottawa, saying that, you know, big questions about vaccines and equating it with human experimentation. It's like, this is coming from the same party. On the one hand, they're screaming about, when is this going to be ready? And then the other hand, you've got a guy who ran for the leadership of the party, by the way, saying that, oh, vaccines, he's pretty much an anti-vaxxer by the sounds of it. So I don't know if people, if they hear these things, might say, oh, I'm not sure if they're the right gang for the job.
Well, I'm not sure if Derek Sloan is like a legit anti-vaxxer or if he's like kind of gay for pay when it comes to anti-vaxxing. But I think that is a big question. And there was some polling done about vaccines. I mean, this all came out of like Erin O'Toole basically standing up every day going like, when are we going to get the vaccine? When are we going to get a vaccine? Mm-hmm. Can we get the vaccine tomorrow? There's also been a lot of hype around the idea that Canada is going to be at the back of the line because we don't produce vaccines. We don't have the capacity. And there's a big, long story about that that goes all the way back to Brian Mulroney. It's like the old Air Force gag. You know, before you say it was Brian Mulroney, let me tell you, it was Brian Mulroney. behind all that, though, it turns out a majority of Canadians like don't mind waiting. 63% of people said that they will get vaccinated, and
especially if Granny's going to get it first, right?
Right,
and prioritize the people that really, really, really should get it before.
Right, and 38% of people said that they would, you know, wait a couple of months, and that's fine. I think it was like 48% of people said that they don't mind waiting. They're not concerned about getting the vaccine first. And one of the most interesting things about this, and Eric Grenier did this analysis on CBC, was that 27% of conservatives said that they would like to get vaccinated ASAP. But it was like 61% said that they would like to get vaccinated eventually. So the vast majority of people who identify as conservative or are conservative supporters, vis-a-vis Erin O'Toole is the one they'd like to see as the next Prime Minister of Canada, they're not, you know, hitting the panic button about getting the vaccine. They're perfectly happy to sit back and wait and like, yeah, we'll get the vaccine eventually. And so at the end of the day is like, what is the event? What is the service of, like, what is it in service of what Erin O'Toole is doing and all this grandstanding he is doing? Is it to step on Trudeau's neck, or is it because there is a silent majority in his party that wants to get that vaccine as soon as it's humanly possible? Because the polling doesn't bear that out. The vast majority of conservative supporters say that they will wait and eventually get the vaccine. So.
And it is an opposition's job to hold the government to account.
Absolutely.
But the way this is being presented, it's to me, from what I've seen, it smacks a bit of cheap points at times. Mm-hmm. Right? So how dare you? And in a very classic move, I saw Trudeau reading the list of companies that left the country under conservative rule to go off somewhere else and make vaccines. I think a lot of Canadians are surprised that we have zero capacity to produce any of this here. It shouldn't be that much of a surprise. If you follow these things and you say, Mulroney, but yeah, Connaught Labs was a big one, and it was a scandal at the time. It's like, why are you selling? We have this capacity. Why are you selling? Well, you know, it's a private sector, can do it better. That's a terrible moral impersonation, actually. I haven't had to do that in 35 years. Is it that long? Holy cow. Anyway, the priorities, yeah. There seems to be a bit of, let's say, handing off of priorities. I've seen Trudeau and Patty Hajdu speaking, and it's like, well, you know, it will be up to the provinces. They do this sort of like, well, we're doing everything we can. It's going to be up to the provinces to decide, which is true because they are indeed in charge of health care. And I've also heard Prime Minister Trudeau saying a couple of times about, well, we're going to leave it to the experts, right? So there is a bit of this deferral as well. I mean, it does seem with the what's come out of Ottawa today with vaccine distribution, there's an air of confidence that this is going to get out there. But there is still this kind of like, well, because the provinces are going to decide where vaccinations will take place because it is up to them. And there was one, I did see one, it was a Streeter where they were talking a bit about vaccine rollout. This was a few days ago. And the reporter was standing in front of the Shoppers Drug Mart. I was like, maybe you'll get it at a place like Shoppers Drug Mart. And I was like, maybe, but you know, I'd prefer to get it at a hospital that has a minus 85 fridge, right? You know, I guess it depends on what vaccine you're going to get and in your area, whatever the distribution points are. So there's still a lot of factors up in the air, but that's where it tends to fall away a little bit, where it's kind of like, well, it's up to the provinces. And the provinces are going to say, well, we don't know yet. We have no, they haven't told us anything. We know as much as you do. So they really need to soften that a bit. And I believe that they're working together. You know, there's probably a conference call every afternoon of, oh, what's going on. But they also need to provide people with a bit more hope rather than trying this whole, well, you know, it's all up in the air. They're like, no, at this point, it shouldn't be up in the air because there's potential vaccines and you should be getting them soon. Let's hope, right?
Well, part of the problem is that there have been mixed messages from the federal government side in terms of like how many vaccines are we getting, when are we getting them, who are we getting them from, and it would be one thing for Trudeau to say like, look, there's a lot of moving parts, we have every country in the world is undertaking its own processes, there are four different vaccines right now, there may be more on the way, there are different considerations for each vaccine, one vaccine doesn't need minus 85 degree refrigerators, another vaccine does, another vaccine, you know, needs it somewhere in the middle. Like there's a lot of up and downs. Like, bear with us, we will make sure everybody in this country gets a vaccine for this.
That wants starting one, it. Right?
Like, yeah, well, I mean, that's the other piece of this too. But instead he jumps up and down. And he's like, oh, no. Like, listen, guys, there's going to be 20 million doses. And they're going to get dropped off at Navdeep Bain's house next week. I swear.
He's got a fridge in the garage that's going to handle it. It's like, there's Molson Canadian and a vaccine for you. So
Bill Blair's driving to Ingersoll to pick up another batch of vaccine tonight, I swear.
Or General Hillier, is that I gotta say, and you probably heard it, that I really, really dislike when they do things like comparing D-Day to what's going on. Like, that didn't give me any confidence. Like, oh, you know, they stormed Normandy, so you can stay home and watch Netflix. And like, everyone knows I have so much respect for any Normandy veteran and knew somebody that was there, actually. But I wasn't too big on that. It's like, you just get a general to handle this. The federal general sounds like he's got it. Hillier, I'm not so sure. Like, he needs to throttle her back
grandstanding. Yeah, there's so much grandstanding and pomposity. Like, there was that picture of Doug Ford on the phone with Pfizer, and it's just like, dude, you're not in charge of vaccine allocation. That comes from the feds. The feds hand it to you for you handle distribution. And I think it was our own MP, Mike Schreiner, who said, like, and I'm paraphrasing here, dude, stick in your lane, because he's not the one who needs to be on the phone with Pfizer to find out when we're going to get stuff. That's Patty Hajdu's job.
Did he have his lab coat on that said Premier? No, I'm just
no, he had a three-piece suit on, and except he wasn't wearing the jacket, so he's sitting there in the vest, and like, it's you know, there's a great big outbreak going on in this province, like 1,700 cases yesterday, 700 1,700 cases the day before. There's a job for the provincial government. It is not in calling Pfizer, but because it's performative, it gets to show Doug Ford as the great big cool businessman type. That's what he does. And everybody just needs to stick to their jobs. Everyone's going to get a vaccine that wants one. It's just going to be a matter of time. And we just have to exercise a little bit more patience. And I did see this. I can't remember who said it because I love to quote them directly. But, you know, the Great Depression was 10 years. World War II was 6 years. The influenza outbreak in 1918 was like 2.5 years. We can't sit tight for another couple of months till we start getting people vaccinated. Are we really that soft? Unfortunately, I think we are.
Yes. Well, on that note, I can't really add any more to that. But speaking of years, it would seem that Dr. Williams of Ontario, the point person, our provincial government's point person when it comes to all things COVID, contract has been renewed. I believe it was supposed to be up in February, but he is foregoing retirement for a little while. It sounds like he's very close to that. I'm not actually sure how old he is. It doesn't actually really matter his age, but he seems like a well-qualified enough individual, but there have been calls from certain quarters, and I remember a bit of this in the summer as well, for him to step down due to the way he has been handling this. And I guess by extension, we should probably talk a bit about the Attorney General of Ontario's report on how the COVID situation has been handled, because it kind of came out of that report that a great infrastructure was created in Ontario that created some lag time between kind of in March when we knew where everything was going to April. Once this infrastructure was created and they said, okay, you should do this, they created a large committee of which Dr. Williams was the head of, but not necessarily the key point person of, by the sounds of it. Now, I did see one criticism of him, which I thought was completely valid, something he said a couple of weeks ago, talking about, and I'm sure you heard this too, Adam, about he had said that he was hoping that the province would be in the green zone by Christmas. And I think anybody who is following anything, whether you have any medical knowledge or you're just a citizen, would say to yourself, that's probably not the case. Even 2 weeks ago, you would say that is not the case. We're seeing the case counts going up virtually everywhere, but obviously in Ontario, it's getting that much higher. To say something like that, the comment was fast and furious from lots of places saying that this guy is out of touch, regardless of how qualified he is on paper. It's like he may not be the person to steer this through what is going to be a dark winter.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I mean, that almost seems like recklessly, well, reckless, I guess. I was gonna say recklessly naive, but I'm pretty sure.
I was like, are you serious, dude? Yeah.
But yeah, that, I mean, it's only, I was trying to think back to my last in-depth conversation with our own medical officer of health, Dr. Mercer, and we did talk about Christmas. This was at the end of October, though, and she was talking about, like, if we basically mind our P's and Q's, we will have, like, a semi-normal Christmas, not one where you will have, like, great big Christmas gatherings with your family, but one where you could, like, go and visit Nana and, you know, drop off some presents and maybe say hi to her from the porch. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We're way past that. I mean, so much has changed in a month, just the rapid increase in the number of cases. No one in their right mind is thinking about a green Christmas, at least in the way that Dr. Williams means it. It's, you know, almost impossible to say at this point if, you know, the places that are in your lockdown now are in the red, might even be able to move to orange at this point. I mean, there was a board of health meeting yesterday, and somebody asked Dr. Mercer, and this is for our area, Wellington, Dufferin, Guelph, if, you know, what are the odds of us moving into the red? And she said, you know, it was her learned opinion that we will likely stay orange. That final decision lies with the province, of course. But, you know, you could practically, you couldn't see her hands or what was going on behind her back, but you could almost sense that she had her fingers crossed behind her back. Mm-hmm. And all she was talking about was, we're in orange, I don't think we're going to go to red. She was not making promises about going back to green at any time soon. It just speaks to, I think what the primary concern, and there was a Toronto Star article about this, was that the primary concern that people have about Williams is that he is just not very good at communicating at a time when we have a lot of reassuring voices. Mm-hmm. You know, you look to the federal government with Dr. Tam. I mean, they have her in commercials. So she speaks very, very well and very reassuringly. You have Dr. Hinshaw in Alberta. You have Dr. Henry in British Columbia. And, you know, we're the biggest province population-wise, 14 million people. Where is our medical officer of health? He's practically invisible until I started looking for pictures of him in articles in this week's show. I probably couldn't have picked him out of a police lineup, but I almost definitely could have picked Dr. Tam, Dr. Hinshaw, and Dr. Henry if somebody had just shown me their pictures without any names. And I think that is probably the most glaring deficit for Dr. Williams right now, is just that he feels almost completely absent in the middle of a public health crisis.
And that's the thing. All of these people have been thrown into this situation, and it doesn't necessarily go with the territory, if you're a very good doctor and very qualified at what you do, that you're necessarily the best communicator, right? Mm-hmm. And the examples that you named, of course. And there was kind of a bit of similar thing happened with Dr. Hinshaw, the secret recordings in Alberta. And the tone of that, which she wasn't happy about it. The government, no one was happy about the release of these, you know, meetings that were supposed to be closed. And how she had said that it made it sound like she was making these suggestions and the government of Alberta was summarily ignoring them, right? And this is sort of the impression I get a bit with Ontario, because Doug Ford was so defensive, not just over the Attorney General's report, but any criticism of Dr. Williams. What was the line he used? His one of his colorful metaphors, like, "Dude, you don't change the dance partner in the middle of the dance, and he's a great dancer." But there was a tone to Doug Ford, like, "How dare you judge us?" But I think the long story short on the report was that Bonnie Lessig was saying that the province wasn't ready. And when people aren't ready, they tend to reach out. It usually involves consultants and like throw money at something, right? We're not ready. Let's get somebody else to tell us how we should be ready. And within that time, people should have been wearing masks and the distancing. There was talk of it, but there was nothing coming from the top saying you have to do this, or the masks are coming from here. And that's where it kind of fell away. And as you said, he's not Dr. Williams' communication skills. If I understand it right, he's not even on. He has no social media, right? He's not. He is old enough to have missed that wave and never had to log into Twitter. And you're talking about looking for pictures of him. I'm told that if you do Google him, you just get the official stuff. There's no, this is the practice of Dr. Whatever, because he's just. But as I said, you're very knowledgeable in public health. You can't. Fault him for that necessarily, but it makes it, I think, do you think maybe that they renewed the contract because it's like we can sort of keep a lock on this guy and he's a known and we know what we're getting, so we don't want to throw somebody into this who may be the greatest communicator but might overshadow or overstep, but in presenting public health information, kind of like Fauci in the States, he became an unlikely hero as well, in some ways, in his own way, standing up to Trump's nonsense, right? Where he's saying, you got to do this. And Trump's like, I didn't really want to go there, but I'm just doing the comparison of like, Fauci says something, is like, I want to listen to that guy. Dr. Williams says something, he's not necessarily the focus of the newscast or anything. He's like the fourth guy. It'll be all the political people, and then maybe Dr. Williams, even though as Ford, it's always here every day. We talk to him every day. And yeah, it makes you wonder where it's going to go. Or could Dr. Williams very quietly over the break say, I had a long walk in the snow and I want to, right?
Talk about your overused political metaphors. But yeah. I think renewing his contract, I don't think it had anything to do with Williams. I think it had everything to do with the perception that there's a strong team behind this. To you know, start the process of looking for a new medical officer of health in the middle of a pandemic. Even if you are changing up someone who has been, you know, censured by the Auditor General for not fulfilling the duties of his office to the most excellent standards he could, it's just a perception thing. It's just, you know, to say goodbye to Dr. Williams in February as the pandemic is kind of still roaring would not look strong. And I think that is, unfortunately, the biggest consideration that Doug Ford has. His own metaphor about, you know, you don't change your dance partner in the middle is sloppy, because if your dance partner steps on your toe and breaks it.
Yeah, if they're drunk or they suck. Yeah.
You're not going to be winning the dance competition, because you're not going to be able to perform to 100%. And I think that's what David Williams has been doing. And it, you know, you made the point, and it was in the Star profile of him. The Star did a big profile of him, and they noted that he has a very small footprint on Google, because anytime you see his name, it's connected to an official statement. He really kind of has no animas beyond that. And to go back to this other op-ed from the Star a couple of weeks ago, it said, you know, the author said that's kind of the point, is because before COVID, the public health goal of the Ford government was to cut and to amalgamate, mm-hmm. and to
soon we forget, right?
And to change things up, right? And
yeah.
Maybe that's why he was appointed. It was because he was the guy who was going to go along with it and not say anything and not rock the boat. And maybe that has come back to bite. I don't know. There is something wrong with that office right now. It is not being as maximized to a degree that it could. And, you know, maybe that has to change. And we can't be afraid to not look at changing things up in the middle of a pandemic just because we're in a pandemic. If something's not working, it's not working, and we should change it.
Save the last dance for me. Yeah, and if I understand it right, the command table that the Auditor General was talking about has 500 people on it. That's not an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. So I would love to know who that is. I mean, it is probably a more the merrier thing when you're talking about distribution, logistics. It's probably the head of every LIN in the province. I'm not sure who's on this table. Seems like a lot, though. And if they are politicos, and not quote political, obviously, you could be on the committee. If that's what you're doing, sort of stuffing this thing to say, yes, we're doing this, but it doesn't necessarily involve things like public health and epidemiologists and people in the know and where are we going to get the syringes, and rather coming up with ways to complain about the federal response. I don't know how that's
going.
But
you have to know who's in charge. Like, you have to know Captain Kirk's in charge, and if Captain Kirk's not here, Spock's in charge, and if Spock's not here, Scotty's in charge. You have to know.
McCoy would have had a vaccine for this in like 3 minutes, right? Well, no needle required, just psst, in the neck, you're good.
He had an hour to fix everything, so there you go.
Yeah, if only it were that easy, but yeah, hopefully the fix will be in as the month goes along. But anyway, you're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. We're heard every Thursday. We're going to take a little bit of a break so we can catch our breaths, but we're going to play a couple of ads and we will be back in short order. So please stay tuned. That was a song called Arrivé by an artist called Briga, and Briga was actually one of the last people to play a live show on our YouTube channel before everything shut down in February. She was backing and supporting Jeff Berner in town, which is the last show I went to before our new life. Anyway, the album's called Territoire, and it's available on Bandcamp, so check that out. And I'm definitely going to check out the rest of that when I get a chance. Speaking of checking out when we get a chance, Adam, you spoke to Ward 1 Councillor Dan Gibson earlier.
Yes, I spoke to him yesterday, which is the day after the budget was passed, and that is mostly what we talked about, although there is a little bit of clarity at the beginning about another matter, but I will let that speak for itself.
Excellent. Let's get to that now.
Thanks for having me, Adam. It's always great to be on the show.
And just to start off with, I know we're going to basically cover a lot of budget stuff, but I did want to address this one point about the town hall you had a couple of weeks ago, and I know there was some static afterwards from some people who felt that some of the discussion did not reflect well on the city's homeless community, that there was some otherizing going on. So I just thought I'd give you a minute or whatever you need just to talk about that.
Yeah. Thanks, Adam. I really appreciate the opportunity, actually. That's a great first question. We made the decision to host a town hall meeting with the chief of police following in the footsteps of Ward 2, Councillor Goller and Councillor Gordon, who held one. And just really in response to some of the concerns that I had been hearing, not some, I mean dozens of concerns that I'd been hearing in the East End, just about community safety, car break-ins and that. And not to draw the correlation to the homeless population at all, never did it enter the question lines other than were the police going to be involved in managing or moving on the encampments that had been set up in the East End. We all acknowledge this is a very sensitive issue. And there's no win when you walk into a situation because there's really, really passionate opinions on both sides. And it is a lose-lose situation. You can't defend it, but you also can't justify it. We have laws in the city that state that you can't live rough in the city. And when those social issues start spilling over into suburban neighborhoods, you're going to get passionate advocates on both sides. So we brought it up at the town hall. The chief handled it very well, and Officer Howe, who came to the meeting, offered it very well. I think it's important to note my opinion was not a part of that discussion. My opinion, I was simply a facilitator of that discussion, and I really like the touch that the Guelph Police Service has. They don't intervene unless there's community concerns. In this case, the community concerns were becoming abundantly clear, and they intervened. I think it's also important to note that while some individuals struggle with the shelter system for whatever reason, past trauma, substance use, or mental health, I acknowledge that those situations exist. However, as a community, we have to remind people that there is space in our shelter, that there is room in our shelter, and we want to house people there as a first choice. There's always going to be individuals that struggle with that, but we are, as a council, working towards some really promising files on supportive housing, which we think we've got some really good partners in coming forward. So thank you for letting me address that, Adam. I appreciate that, and I hope that sort of...
You're not deaf to the issues, is what you're kind of saying. Yeah,
I am a voice of the community, and I have supported the supportive housing file on the ones coming forward. I raised my objections a year ago on the Beaumont Crescent simply because I had serious concerns about the viability of that location. A month later, the rest of council agreed with me that wasn't the best location, and so moving forward, I think we're all unified in trying to get something real and tangible started. The Parkview Motel and the Skyline and Kindle proposals are exciting, and we're hoping that they're going to be a good fit for the city.
Perfect. Now to get to the big news of the week, which was the budget, and maybe just to start on that topic, sure. What were your general thoughts about the process this year and maybe how it was different from past years?
Yeah, so process-wise, it was more involved. It was more condensed. But I think in the end of the day, it helped us stay focused on the task at hand. It's not, spreading out the budget over 6 or 7 meetings at some times can seem a bit choppy. Really has a hard time getting its rhythm. In this situation, we had public delegation night. We had the day that we received the overall budget, and then we had the day that we passed the budget. All the while, council had full resources of staff at our disposal, as well as the budget board. So I think the process was really well done. I ended up taking 2 days vacation to take care of it, but that's okay. This is part of the role we play. And at the end of the day, I think it probably went as smooth as possible given the year that we're in.
That is interesting to note that, and I think a lot of people were probably surprised, number one, how smoothly it went, at least for me as an observer, how smoothly it went, how low the levy went down. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, there were certain compromises, and we can get into those.
Sure,
but I mean,
sure.
Was it, how important was it, or I guess maybe let me phrase it this way, for your priorities, your specific priorities going into this, how did you look at the budget? Like, what were your goals specifically going into it?
Right. So something that I learned probably about 2 years ago, in terms of when we're going into a fairly contentious process, whether it be the library, for example, or the tax levy, the infrastructure tax levy, or this year's budget, it is important to be as transparent as possible with your intentions to the community so that they know where you stand. And if it is going to be some big grand negotiation of council, not having surprises for your colleagues in the last minute is probably the best way to maintain and manage relationships. So I posted my intentions very early on last week about my a responsible approach to the budget 2021 in response to COVID. I made it very clear that we as a city have done patting our own backs, but we have done a job, good or bad, we have done a good job rebuilding our reserve funds from 2014 to 2020 over a 6-year period. We went from a low of around $2 million to almost $13 million in our rate stabilization reserve, which is the reserve we specifically use at tax time to offset one-time costs or alleviate the tax pressure in that year. So I made it very clear that I was coming to support community groups in need with immediate one-time funding out of reserves, but at the same time, fully acknowledging that there are many in our community that have not either returned to work, have returned to work part-time, may have lost a business, a spouse is out of work, or are simply not returning to the workforce the way they want to because of COVID. And in those situations, as a counselor, you hear those stories that don't always show up at City Hall. But as counselor, you do hear those stories about people who are struggling and really needed the support from the city to not impact their household budget anymore. They're going to be, and businesses as well, they'll be digging out of these holes for a number of years in terms of, you know, many have retapped into their mortgage to help offset costs, retapped into lines of credit. Those things take time to reestablish moving forward. So, and mm-hmm. again, we can't do much in terms of social supports if we don't have a tax base to support them. So,
right. In a sense, then, does, I mean, the it strikes me that getting it to 2.5 or 2.25 is kind of, at once, there's the practical considerations of, this is a rough year for a lot of people. And as you said, people aren't going to come to city council and delegate like, hey, I lost my job this year. So
They don't. No, right. People are proud. They don't want to admit that. You're right.
Yeah. And then the flip side of it too, and I was thinking about this during the meeting, this is pretty good PR in advance of what are going to be some difficult decisions with going back to certain spending levels next year, right? That
sure.
You guys did the hard work. You made a lot of tough decisions about spending from the tax reserve, not implementing certain things, skipping the hospital levy this year to get that down. But I mean, that is in a sense banking a lot of goodwill, saying to the general public, see, we can tighten our belts when the time comes.
I agree. I agree on some aspects, and I disagree on some. On the fact that we can tighten our belt in a given year and show the community that we understand what many are going through, absolutely. And that comes all the way back to the leadership I believe we showed at the very beginning of the night, where we froze council salaries, we froze the mayor's salary, and we froze all management salary across the board, mm-hmm. saying this is a big piece to the increase every single year. We understand this is not a time to be giving ourselves the rate of inflation increases. Many are not seeing those raises, so we should be all in this together and lead by example. And I think we've done that. That was the tone that was set early. In terms of PR, I won't speak to the PR. Again, every year I come with the same focus at budget, which is to not ask or collect a dollar more than what our city needs to operate. I don't believe in taxing for the sake of taxing. I believe in using taxes only for what we need. And then the rest of the money can stay in the homes and in the businesses where it belongs. So in terms of putting on the pressure for next year, Adam, you've been around this horseshoe with us for 6 years. It is the exact same line every single year. Mm-hmm. Every single year, we talk about putting more pressure on next year's budget. And when I woke up this morning, I said, it's good that there's pressure on next year's budget already, because every single year, we should be doing the exact same focus, which is what is absolutely critical and necessary and what is not. Some would say that's short-term thinking, Dan. But at the same time, I've said this many times, taxes are always... There's only one night a year where you can really impact the tax rate, and taxes are always determined in the margins. The taxes don't go up or go down with a silver bullet. You can never point to one or two items in a budget to say, okay, now my taxes are high or now my taxes are low. It's always determined by marginal incremental increases or incremental savings. $15 here, if you focus on $15, you can say that's half a cent to every single person in the city. What's that worth? But if you make 100 decisions like that, all of a sudden you're making an impact to the positive or the negative. So in terms of putting pressure on next year's budget, I welcome that, and we'll have to get creative again next year.
And I would say, standing adjacent to the horseshoe all this time, is wasn't multi-year budgeting supposed to help cure us of some of those assumptions?
So I won't lie, I'm a fence sitter on multi-year budgeting. I always have been. Going through it for the first time this year, I saw a little bit of what I think multi-year budgeting as a strategy is intended to do, which is, listen, if we're going to say we're just going to pass 3.5% tax increases every single year through multi-year budget, I mean, that's an easy, quick answer. But at the same time, do we need to pass 3.5% every single year? We know that there's big costs coming on the rec center in the South End and on the Baker Street Library. We know those are going to be large incremental base costs in the years that they open. That being said, that does not mean that we should be collecting the taxes to operate them now. And that money will not be spent on the library. That money will go into a reserve or another operating line. And we are simply ramping in the impact of that budget, that new cost. We're not actually collecting for the cost itself. I think that's a strategy in multi-year budgeting that I haven't warmed up to. Last night there was $800,000 earmarked for the South End Rec Center incremental increases in operating costs before we had a rec center. And there's a $500,000 increase in the library operating costs before we actually have a library. So when you put it together, there's $1.3 million of taxes being collected for what will eventually be a library, but it's not going to be spent on a library or a rec center. It'll just go into the general coffers. And that was something that I called out a few times and I voted accordingly to reduce those numbers.
Is that... And I understand your arguments too, but I think one of the things we learned from the police increase last year is that those sudden spikes to cover like systemic underfunding, or even, I mean, this isn't the same case, but I mean, people don't like those sudden spikes either. To just sort of jump 30% right. increases on people in one department is difficult to swallow too.
I agree. I think I completely agree with you. And maybe a better example is the fire station that was opened up prior to me joining council in, I think, 2010, where they added 30 or 40 staff to the emergency services center in the South End. That was a sudden spike that just came on board. The police budget, I'll be honest, I've got lots of opinions on the police budget, and I've been looking at that budget for many years in comparison to other cities our size. We were adding, you know, 1%, 2%, 3% budgets to the police budget while our city was growing at 3, 4, 5, 6% a year. Mm. We were simply falling behind on our policing costs. And I think a lot of the symptoms that you saw prior to last year's 10% increase were symptomatic of a city that wasn't policed like other cities are. You saw the crime rates and you saw the response times and you saw everything going the wrong way, especially violent crimes were going the wrong way. People weren't even reporting property crimes anymore. To this year, where we're trying to reestablish that presence in the downtown, we're trying to reestablish that presence in the neighborhoods, and we'll see. I mean, all indications are that we're starting to see a drop in some of those indicators. But as the chief says, we don't want to see it as a 1-year blip. We want to see it as a trend.
Right.
Yeah.
I do want to address a couple of the motions you brought forward before we ran out of time. Hopefully this will be, we'll see what happens if the length of your answer, but or the length of my question, but bringing forward a motion on microtransit, I think one of the things that concerns me as a transit user, and I think concerns a lot of people, is that, not to accuse you of anything, but the perception being that moving to a microtransit option creates a sense of like this is a magic solution to both the funding issues of transit and the issues of, you know, underserviced routes as well. I mean, so can you talk about your vision for microtransit?
Sure. And we could probably do an interview just on transit, actually.
Yes,
I've done a lot of reading on transit remarkably over the last a month or so. But so I think the starting point is this in 2020 and projected probably for the next 3 to 4 years, our ridership dipped by 65% in this city. That doesn't require cuts to a service. That is simply the reality. That's the new revenue that we're getting. But I think if you look at the end of the year, we're targeting around an $8 to $10 million loss in overall revenues for transit. We can only mitigate that so much with the standard routes that we run and with the coverage that we're doing and with the size of the buses that we're running. And so we had to look at evolving transit using the Guelph Transit service. I'm not talking about outsourcing and I'm not talking about using third party. I think that is a separate issue that we have to talk about through collective agreements. And that wasn't on the table last night, just to be very clear. But the report that we received from staff on October 30th spoke to the actual rider experience with microtransit. So a smaller bus, for starters. It's a smaller bus, but we believe we're going to be able to increase the rider satisfaction through microtransit, simply because it is an on-demand service. As long as you're handy and you're on top of your schedule with your smartphone, you should be able to schedule your rides similar to a taxi, just on a small bus, from one point to your individual location on a route. Some of the other benefits we looked at, you know, all before the cost savings, but we can increase our service area. So the best example I use is the Hanlon Creek Business Park. With microtransit, what would happen is you get picked up at the Emergency Services Center on the South End on Clare Road, which is on a standard transit route. But then anywhere on that loop within the Hanlon Creek, you can go from the Emergency Services Center to the front door or within a reasonable location of that front door on that microtransit. So you're not going stop to stop. You're going stop to door, which is that last mile that people keep talking about, which is an inhibitor to people using transit. It's much more flexible. So instead of us simply doing the blanket 15-minute or 20-minute or half-hour routes where we can have really slow times, we can actually start tracking individual routes, and we can track and chase people as they need to move around on these routes. So from a being nimble as a service, I think it adds to that. And then lastly, just because you're not putting those large big buses on a blanket coverage route, you're going to save costs going to a more nimble targeted type of service. I saw it as an opportunity to get the service into the Hanlon Creek at a cost, as a cost plus to the budget. So we were told the Hanlon Creek service was going to cost about $600,000. What we were able to achieve last night is giving staff delegated authority to pick the three to four other routes in the city that are underperforming or underserviced or are poor ridership, target those with microtransit, use the savings there to offer the transit service in the Hanlon. This is not an attempt by anybody to reduce the level of service across the city. It's simply looking to evolve the service.
And I mean, there's going to be some reports before anything happens as well. So if people are concerned that things are going to happen without much notice, that, you know, there'll be lots of notice.
Yeah. Public notices, implementation plans. You're going to figure out probably going to be a good user guide on how to use it, how to use microtransit. But I think the most important thing that we achieved through that motion last night was that we did provide delegated authority to staff to do it. So there's not going to be any return to council for approval of routes. We don't want to see councillors sort of gerrymandering routes where they think it's most needed. This is not our role. Our role is not to administer the program. Our role is to decide on the program. And I think we achieved that last night, and I'm excited to see what transit is going to do.
We are running out of time. I could poke at that further, but
no problem.
I did want to ask you about another particular motion of yours, which was about the cutting the rentals for the rec facilities.
Oh, yes.
I know, and people who may follow you on Instagram know this is probably a little close to your heart. Your boys play Little League ball.
Yep. So as do thousands of other kids.
As do
make
thousands,
clear that
yeah, it's not a Dan Gibson issue or a Gibson
that's right
issue, but I mean, you do offer a perspective sort of inside what's going on with these sports organizations right now. And can you talk a little bit about that, the challenges they're facing and what you're seeing as a parent with kids in Little League?
Absolutely. It was a really disappointing part of the evening, and I've often wondered if it was better to be brought forward by somebody other than me, just because I was nervous about how people were perceiving the motion. But last night, council moved $1.4 million of emergency supports, one-time funding through reserve funds, to the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition, Arts and Tourism, Small Business Supports, police background checks, Welcoming Streets, Court Support Worker, and Community Benefit Grants. The only group that was left out were nonprofit small youth associations.
Right.
It was unfathomable for me that would ever fail. And to go from 13-0 on every other vote to go to 7-6 on this vote was shocking. People really forget that these associations pay rent in this city. They pay taxes on those rentals in this city. They have real estate in this city that they're having to manage. They have lines of credit. They buy thousands of dollars in new equipment every year at Christmas time in advance of their seasons, and they were hit with zero revenue last year. All of them, from football to Guelph Gators to the Giants hockey, everyone is seeing a massive hit to their income streams, but really minimal benefits on their costs. Their costs are still fixed like a small business. So we just decided that they didn't qualify last night. So I'm going to hold my comments on how the vote broke down in terms of the vote was very interesting. If you look at how the vote broke down in terms of empty nesters and families, it was incredible on this issue to have such division on this council. It really struck me as that. So that being said, I'm happy that we got the police background checks subsidy through to flow through, because as many who will be listening to this radio show know, one of the largest groups of volunteers in this community are the thousands of parents that volunteer with youth sports organizations, and all of those parents have to go through background checks. So I was pleased at least that is going to go down through supports, but I perhaps I was disappointed in the vote. I took me 10 minutes to get over it. But at the same time, I think I reiterated during the meeting that I'm here to support community. And I was here coming and willing to push yes buttons on providing those supports. And at the end of the day, I was very happy with the supports that council did provide.
Diplomatic as always, and we'll have to leave it there. Dan,
good try.
Thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much, Adam. Really appreciate it.
As a taxpayer, Adam, I feel you covered a lot of turf there.
Good. I'm glad. That was the point.
Yeah, we could get into it a bit, but I'm afraid we're out of time. So, yeah, that's good stuff. Nothing more to add other than you're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. We are heard here every Thursday. We are heard on the repeat, I think, tomorrow morning, Friday morning, possibly Monday morning. You can find us at CFRU.ca. You can find us at a ton of places, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, correct? Mm-hmm. Okay, I need to stop asking whether I'm correct. Adam, if people want to find out more about you and what you do in this town, where can they do that?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can go to GuelphPolitico.ca as well.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and Scotty Hertz right here at CFRU 93.3 FM, remotely, but there in spirit from our respective places. So please tune in next week. Thank you so much for joining us, and take the best of care.